there are absolutely relationships based on cultural patterns and, you know, the things I described that can identify geographically where a wine will be more successful or not.
Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider.
Change your business if you could predict how successful your products would be before you launched them? Or what about if you wanted to create something very risky and somebody gave you a map of all of the places where it was guaranteed to sell? Or how would it change your life if you'd launched a product that wasn't working and somebody could tell you how to fix it? The technology to do all of this exists, and it's been developed by a California company called Tastry. Tastry was founded by Katarina Axelson in 2014, and she started it while she was still a chemistry student at Cal Poly. She'd got a job working at a winery, and she watched as a 100,000-gallon tank was divided and sold to two different brands, and the same wine ended up selling at different prices, and it got different scores. As soon as she saw that, she thought the wine industry was ready for disruption. So what Tastry does is it uses chemistry and machine learning to understand wines, not by looking at a single flavour molecule at a time, but by understanding how the total chemistry in each wine interacts as a whole. Tastry also conducted consumer tastings to understand how consumers respond to the chemistry of what they're drinking. Today, Tastry offers insights into everything from how to tweak wines to get a better sales outcome to knowing how retailers can build better assortments. Now, I know that lots of people listening to that are going to cringe, thinking that what Tastry is offering is the kind of data-driven approach that has wreaked havoc in other creative areas. We've all seen that film and television has become more formulaic, and none of us want a fix that's going to make wine more homogenous. But what Tastry is doing is quite different. As Katarina says during the conversation, it can be used to prove that a creative risk is worth taking. After we finished recording, Katarina told me how worried she was about some of the AI offerings out there, which promise the world but deliver very little, which she thinks is going to lead to a backlash against machine learning at a time when this technology is poised to unlock some of science's deepest questions. We also covered entrepreneurship, and another thing she told me later was how surprised she was at how hard it was to get people to consider change, even if you could prove that the change was going to bring a better outcome. Altogether, it was an amazing conversation that ranged from flavour to people management to cultural differences in taste. And don't forget, if you want the takeaways, just sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter at www.drinksinsider.com. Katarina, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I've been reading about your work and some of what you've done is amazing, but it is very complex. So I'm going to jump in by talking about something that everybody's talking about at the moment, which is smoke taint, which is one of the problems that you can deal with. So pretend that I'm a small batch winemaker and I believe that my wine is affected by smoke taint and I bring it to you. Can you help me? And if so, what are the steps you take?
Yes, we've been very successful at solving smoke taint issues. The way we do this is you send us a sample like you would to any other lab. We have a commercial lab. We analyze that sample using a unique methodology, and the output, the chemistry that we received, is interpreted by machine learning algorithms that will predict what has to happen to receive a favorable outcome in the chemistry. So it comes out with a recipe based on the targets you set for it. So send a sample as you would any other lab, and then you log into the dashboard and essentially Tastry tells you what you need to do to solve the problem.
And this is a problem that you've actually solved for people who've come to you in the past, is that correct?
Oh, many times. The smoke taint, the wildfire season is, we were very early on in launching the product at that time, and it actually brought us a lot of goodwill in the industry because we were solving some very serious emergencies using the technology.
Okay. So once you've determined that my batch is full of smoke taint, what happens next?
Well, it depends on what the AI determined is going to give you the best possible outcome. It just runs simulations on what is happening in the chemistry. So it will say it depends on the unique flavor matrix of that wine, what you do. Every wine is completely different. Every flavor chemistry is completely different. That's why humans can't do this, right? So depending on the sample and depending on the ratios of the other compounds in that sample, you might be told to use a certain kind of oak that balances those ratios out. You might be told to use reverse osmosis because there won't be as much of an impact on taking the flavor out of the wine. You might be treating it with carbon. It completely depends. There's a lot of adjuncts and a lot of tools that winemakers have, in the winemaking process.
Okay, so let's go right back to the beginning. How did you build up this knowledge of the chemistry of wine? I mean, I know that some chemistry already exists. There's a lot of research done on individual compounds, but you're not interested just in individual compounds, you're interested in how they all interact. So how did you build up this body of knowledge?
Yes, well, that took many years and millions of dollars in research and development. But yes, there's a lot of research out there in the wine industry and in the CPG industry in general, looking at does this compound produce this flavor or sensory experience with consumers. But we felt that that was inadequate if you wanted to influence product development, because the presence or absence of any one compound is not really predictive of how much consumers like things, and you may or may not perceive certain chemistries depending on everything else that is happening in that complex chemical soup. So I think there's a limitation in the methodology to understand everything that affects how a human likes a wine, right? So
okay, so this gets to the heart of this. This is such an interesting thing, but it's also, again, an extremely complex thing. So many people have looked at the chemistry of wine as in, do you like the cherry flavor, do you like this, but what you've discovered is that the compound that produces cherry flavor for one person might be something else for somebody else, and in any case it doesn't say anything about whether they like that flavor or not. Can you talk a little bit about that and how you discovered that?
I think I just noticed in research papers, I like to read research papers in my free time and go down rabbit holes. It's just the way my brain has always worked. And I just noticed a lot of the insights were inconclusive, right? It would be like we generally believe benzaldehyde produces a cherry flavor, but that's with Americans. In Europe, people don't use the same language to describe the same experience. In Europe, it's described as marzipan, right? And in different concentrations, some people might describe it as cherry, and in different concentrations, they'll describe it as marzipan. And it was just like a very much hit or miss, like subjective thing. Like we're objectively measuring something, but the way we translate it to understanding what humans experience is completely objective to subjective, if that means. So machines don't look at chemistry or experiencing it the way humans do. There's context that's missing. So looking at specific compounds is irrelevant. How often does a specific compound exist in nature? It doesn't. It usually exists with a lot of other compounds, and that affects what you experience. Like, for example, I might like a steak and I might like honey. As on their own, that does not mean I like honey on my steak, right? And that's what's happening in the chemistry. So you have to look at everything all at once, because as a human, that's how you're experiencing things, right? When I'm drinking this coffee, I'm experiencing 800 or so compounds at once, not one compound at a time. So it was really about how do we understand the ratios and interdependencies and relationships between all the chemistry, not just that one compound, right? Because benzaldehyde is an example I use often, because almost every single red wine has the benzaldehyde in it, but you don't describe every wine as tasting like cherry. So it's not because of benzaldehyde. It's because that compound could be masked completely by everything else that's going on in there, or it could be overexpressed and exaggerated because of the absence of other compounds. So our methodology was designed to look at the compounds and their natural ratios in one snapshot, and then I can't possibly tell you all the ways those things come together to give you a desired outcome, but we do use machine learning, and it will very much predict that. It will very much predict what the outcome would be, and that is the most accurate way to do it.
Okay, so let's talk about the flavor matrix. So we've determined that individual compounds are really not very helpful. So how do you predict what somebody is likely to like? How do you work it out?
Well, we trained our algorithms by having a big, deep knowledge of as many wine chemistries as possible. So step one was we had a methodology that could give us such an in-depth view on the chemistry. So once we had that efficacy confirmed, we analyzed tens of thousands of wines year over year. But then we had to tie that chemistry to humans. And in order to do that, we had to pour thousands of wines to thousands of people like you would in a classical, you know, professional double-blind tasting panel. So we would tie the chemistry data to humans tasting those wines. And we were very much focused on how consumers liked the wines. There was a lot of we're woefully short on that research. A lot of the research is focused on what we perceive, not how much we like it.
Which is why that's very interesting. So how did you test for that? So if I was one of the people that you were pouring for, and I tasted the wine, what do I do next? Do I fill out a sheet telling you how much I like it, or how does it work?
That's right. You taste the wine, and we try not to cognitively overload. So there were different renditions of the experimental design, right? But the number one thing we want you to answer is how much from a scale, you know, of 1 through 9, for example, do you like this wine? And we would define that scale. And then we would, you would come back the next week, and we might change the order or have a different wine or have the same wine in the mix to see if you would rate it differently or not. So there was a lot of wines consumers would taste.
That's really interesting, because one of the things that comes up in wine judging is this question of, you know, how much can people replicate their own taste? That one thing they like on one day, they won't like on another day. When you were serving the same wines to the same people, what did you discover about people's tastes? How sort of idiosyncratic is it, or how regularly do they like the same things?
Yeah, generally people's tastes are quite predictable, and there are latent variables that affect how you rate the wine that have nothing to do with the taste, absolutely, but it's still predictable. So for example, if I gave you a blind taste of a Oregon Pinot one day and you rated it an 8 out of 9, and 2 weeks later you unknowingly you rate that a 7 out of 9, I know there's a little bit of a range where you could waver by maybe 1 or 2 points. You're never going to rate that Oregon Pinot a 2 or a 1, right? There's a window, a relatively narrow window where you will rate a wine more or less highly. The most predictable aspect of consumer likability when it's tied to chemistry is actually how much you dislike things. So
that's interesting.
So I would get this question a lot in the beginning. I think I was giving a talk at a summit at a winery once, and someone asked me, well, what if I'm in a good mood and I'm having a good experience and I rate the wine highly because it was a great day, and then I buy it and I take it home and I don't feel the same way about that wine because I'm not having a good day the next time I have that wine. And I said, yes, that's true, but that's not the secret to understanding consumer preferences. It's all about avoiding a negative experience that makes you like something. Mm. So that's why we say people don't like what they don't like more than they like what they like. So you're right. So for example, if there's a food you absolutely hate, I don't know what, if you don't like tomatoes or blue cheese or something like that. Yeah. You can have the best day of your life. Does that suddenly mean you like blue cheese or tomatoes?
No, avocado will still remain disgusting. That's absolutely
exactly right. On the best day of your life. And that's what the technology is really pinpointed and figuring out, is what is the negative preference? Because if you can eliminate that, things become very predictable.
This is fascinating. So how much is this stable over time? Because we know that people's tastes do change, not just because they get, you know, less sensitive as you get older, but also because taste is to a certain extent socially mediated. So what do you know about taste? If somebody strongly dislikes something, is that it for all time? They're always going to dislike it? Or can their taste change and can you capture that?
It's actually, it's very variable and depends on the person, but yes, tastes do change over time. I would explain this as the way we see it is, are you capable of evolving your tastes or not? So there are consumers, for example, who will forever be drinking the $10 bottle of Moscato, and that's what they're going to do. That's what they like. There are very young newcomer consumers to the category that have the preferences and the palate to be drinking very robust, high-end, $800, you know, a bottle cult wines, right? If I gave them that wine as they started drinking for their first time, they would not like it, even though they will eventually like it. They're just not ready for it. You have to ease into it. So for example, I didn't start out drinking Burgundies, right? I had some easier wines in my journey, but I had enough positive experiences that I navigated into a place where I can drink a stronger wine and my palate would like that. So yes, some people do, some people don't, if that makes sense. But newcomers are not going to be drinking those.
It does. Mm-hmm. So we're slightly off the topic of chemistry, and I will get back to that. But the person who starts on a $10 Pinot Grigio and stays with a $10 Pinot Grigio, is there something different about that person, or are we talking about socioeconomics and that's just what they're exposed to and that's what they can afford? If they were given other things, would they learn to like it? Or are there some people who forever are going to just be happy with the $10 Pinot Grigio?
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't want to speak to things that are not my core competency, and their marketing and pricing, right? We can predict pricing, but those affect wine buying behavior, absolutely. They don't affect repurchasing behavior as much, but there are things like demographics, and certain demographics are women of certain age ranges or men will buy certain brands, and everyone wants to know, is their palate... Why? What is it about these men or these women's palates that makes them like this wine? And I have to tell them, like absolutely nothing. Like, the marketing captured those consumers that happen to like those wines, and there are many other consumers that will like those wines, but they'll never buy it because of the branding, right?
Right.
So there's factors like, yeah, economic. Your economic, you know, disposition that makes you buy or not buy certain things, absolutely. But there's still people who have all the money in the world who have a very rigid palate as well, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I've spoken to private wine buyers who work with extremely rich people, and sometimes I've been told their palates are very, very narrow. Okay, so let's go back into the chemistry. I'm going to dare to go where I absolutely don't understand what you're talking about, but I'll try. Okay, so what were you discovering about the wines when people said, I like this, I don't like this? Or what were you looking for in asking them that?
I was looking for what is the context and the overlapping chemistries in that wine? What are the interdependencies in that chemistry that are acceptable or unacceptable for this person, right? That's what it's identifying, is for you, in what context and under what circumstances is that going to work? The problem is that's not a very simple or satisfying answer, because there's hundreds of compounds and there's hundreds of reasons they will or will not be acceptable to you. And the reasons for me are going to be completely different. I cannot explain it. I can predict it very well. I can predict if I analyze the chemistry of this wine, right? I can, with 93% accuracy, like, identify how a group of consumers, how much they're going to like it as on average or as individuals. But they will all, I could predict how much, but it will all be for different reasons that they can't understand or explain. It's very unsatisfying, but it's very accurate. That is the
most. How long did it take you to develop that?
millions, 4 years at least. I mean, there's always constant, you know, improvements and growth. But yeah, at least 4 years, and not just me. I mean, mathematicians, data scientists, PhD chemists, a lot of multidisciplinary type people who had to make this work.
Okay, so I'll come to a practical example. So say I'm a winery, I produce a Chardonnay. I think it's fantastic, it's great fruit, but somehow the public is just not taking to it. And I come to you and say, can you help me improve this? What happens next? What are the steps that we go through?
We analyze it in about 24 hours. We have what we have done, the results you're reviewing from that analysis is we took that chemistry. We have a database, a cloud of consumer palates, real and synthetic, that we run a simulation of that wine chemistry against. And it's basically simulating a scenario of 248 million Americans had tasted and rated this wine. How would they have rated it? And then we look at that data. So it's kind of like running a multi-million dollar, multi-year focus group, but you're doing it in minutes, right? At a tiny fraction of the cost. So what it's doing is it's saying, okay, if 248 million Americans tasted this wine, what would the outcome be? And then we look at that and we say, okay, is this the most possible favorable outcome or not? Because what it's also doing is it's running different renditions of the chemistry that are possible within that wine exist, what would be the best possible reality for that wine? Okay, it's not the one we have now. Then what is the best possible scenario? What has to happen in the chemistry to get this outcome? And then there's a recipe that you can use to achieve that outcome, whether or not you like. Or sometimes, you know, you might say, no, this is exactly what I have to use and I have to bottle. Tell me where or with whom or under what circumstance people would like this the most.
Let's take both of these scenarios. So I've decided that I'm happy to change the wine. When you say there's a recipe, what sort of recipe are you talking about? Are you saying give it different oak treatment? Are you saying what sort of recipes do you offer?
Oh, yeah. So oak is a big one. Acids. Some high-end wineries don't use any adjuncts at all, right? They only use cooperage, but it might be blending. It might be like, okay. Do I put in 10% of this Syrah or 5%, right? Things like that.
All right. So, and now I go, you know what? I'm an artist. I'm not touching this. Tell me where I can sell it. How do you know?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's not there's no way to answer that in two sentences. So we have a robust data set on consumer palates and preferences attached to zip codes across the U.S. We have a consumer-facing recommender product that helps us understand consumer migration patterns and things like that. And that was another side of the business that allowed us to do what we're doing. And there are absolutely relationships based on cultural patterns and, you know, the things I described that can identify geographically where a wine will be more successful or not.
In principle, I understand what you're talking about. So when I came from Australia, I really liked, you know, big fruit, and I was shocked at how acidic the wines in my local area. I live in Germany. And then I got reverse culture shock when I went back to Australia and I was like, where's the acidity? So I can see just on myself, N equals one, of how your taste changes. But mm-hmm. that's a very different thing from being able to tell it as accurately as you can. How on earth were you able to build a geographic map of the US and know how people taste in different places?
Yeah, so there's three data sets. One we talked about, which is we had thousands of consumers taste the wines. That helped us understand how to tie the chemistry to consumer preferences. Then what we did is we also had those consumers answer questions about foods and flavors they like that had nothing to do with wine, which, by the way, there's also different preferences for foods and flavors that have nothing to do with wine geographically. So it was kind of perfect, right? So there's a relationship between foods and flavors you like and the kinds of wines you like. So because those consumers who had tasted those wines answered these questions, we found a relationship between that, and we don't have to have you do a tasting panel with us or tell us what wines you like for us to be able to predict that now. All I have to do is send you a whimsical 20-question quiz, even if you've never had wine before in your life, and it will identify what flavor chemistries you're going to like in wine. So that was launched across the U.S. through e-commerce sites, in brick and mortar stores, like through various mediums wherever people were purchasing wine. And we got over 120,000 palate changes every day, in different zip codes across the US and those consumers. The way we take 120,000 people and turn it into understanding what 248 million people like is because I'm trying not to nerd out too much.
Go for broke.
It's called a derivation of a Bayesian ridge, and what it does is it looks
at those. Okay, that's pretty nerdy.
Yeah, it looks at the population density, like whether it's a cosmopolitan city, right? Like what are the migration patterns, even product movement in those areas, and it fills in the gaps. It looks at the data you're missing. And it fills in the gaps based on the data it already has. So it creates synthetic data. So there's fake data. It's saying, I'm predicting if I had all these people, these would be their palates based on the palates I already have.
That's what linguists do to uncover dead languages, actually.
That's right.
It's really interesting. Okay, so in theory, if you had a block in New York and it was Italian restaurants were doing super well there, would you be able to predict what wine would be popular there just on what the taste of that block obviously is?
A specific block?
Yeah, no, well, no. So I'm asking, I don't think this is what you do. This is me thinking about what you're saying. If you looked at a particular area and all of the restaurants and all of the bodegas and stuff were selling a very particular type of thing, could you extrapolate from that and go, I bet they'll like this type of wine?
Yes, I could. There's a better way to do it, but that is absolutely something we have done, and we can do it well. What I would challenge in that notion is you are operating under the assumption that just because that wine is there and it's successful, that there isn't
a better one.
That there isn't something that could be better that we just don't know of yet, or that people are buying it because they like it. And we could see that. We can see that on the data. Yeah.
That's really interesting. So they may be buying it because there's no choice and that's what they have to buy. But actually there could be something that might work much better. You seen any examples of that?
Yeah, we do that. We do that very often. We see one popular example is there's very successful wine brands out there who gain a lot of momentum and acquire a lot of customers because the customers actually do like that wine, but then a big conglomerate will purchase them and then start changing the recipe. And for a period of time, they will still sell the wine, but they're writing off the brand equity. So the consumers will start liking the product less and less, and it dwindles over time. But there's a period of time where you can really profit off of the brand, right?
There's very famous examples of that. So how long do you think people will tolerate this degradation before they notice it? Is there a sort of time period that everyone should be aware of, or is it depend on other factors?
I think it could last for a while, because especially if people don't have can think of a better alternative. Like, I can't tell you how many wine drinkers I've talked to who have said, I don't want to say a specific brand name, but they'll say, oh man, I used to, a decade ago, I just fell in love with this popular wine brand name. And recently it's just gotten too sweet or something. I don't know. And I'm like, well, you keep buying it? And they're like, yeah, I don't know. What else am I going to buy, right? What else do I know? There's a way to fix that. But that's another reason it could last a while is it's quite risky to spend $20 not knowing how you're going to like something.
that's really – so do you now walk into wine shops and think to yourself, oh, this assortment's not right?
It depends on the wine shop. I mean, I would say in like a big box grocery store, the gatekeepers have gotten into this habit of instructing wineries or all the wines are kind of starting to taste the same, if that makes sense. Like people kind of try to chase the golden goose and replicate something that's working. And it's just, it's making things very, very boring in large productions, right? It's very homogenous and it doesn't provide the best outcome or the best wine at all. That's just, people just are inclined to be copycats. We steer customers away from that. So I would say, I'm definitely seeing that in some cases, but I mean, there's some small family-owned brands who don't have the pressure, those similar like business pressures, right? And they make very eclectic, very unique wines that a lot of customers would like, but they just have never heard of it before. And I love those wines. So I could see both sides of it.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting, but the use of the sort of the inappropriate use of data is actually killing lots of creative industries. You know, it's flattening things rather than, you know, we can see this in Hollywood, for example, and that's all data driven. So I want to come back to this interesting point. I'll just go back.
Just really quick on that point. Copycats in the industry, we do the exact opposite of that, and I could explain that, but human beings have been doing that just fine without data for years. In this industry, decades, yeah. In fact. So I'm just saying data is something they could use to do more of the bad things they were already doing, it seems like.
That's true. That is very true. Okay, so can you please explain, at the moment, for example, everybody's thinking a lot about Gen Z, Gen X, millennials, about income, age, demographics. But if I understand you, that's not necessarily as important as other things, or am I wrong? Are those things really important when you're looking at a market?
I mean, it is in the sense that if you want the customer to ever buy your product in the first place, you can't talk to them the way you were talking to other generations. When it comes to palettes are so diverse, it's almost like a fingerprint. I can't make a generalization about, oh, millennials like this, or, you know, Gen X people like Y. The problem is the way we're approaching the customer with sales and marketing. If you can get them to drink wine, their palates would appreciate all sorts of wines just fine.
Right. Okay. Okay. So let's talk about something like the LCBO, which has got 22,000 SKUs. They have to buy for the whole region and they have to, how far away are we from something where I could walk into one of their stores and know quickly which bits of the assortment would suit me and which wouldn't?
I would love to talk to the LCBO. I think it's a perfect fit, especially because from what I understand, those organizations, they are very, very motivated to be objective. So I hope not too far off. It would be very easy to have a lot of reach relatively quickly with something like the LCBO, right?
Assuming we can sell both the LCBO and System Belagert on your services, how would it work, or could it work in theory?
Well, I would be optimistic that we would analyze a lot of wines that they are considering or caring or what it may be, and they would objectively see what is serving and is not serving the customer base, and then use that data to make more intelligent assortment decisions. So one thing we see in retail, for example, when we look at an assortment, right, is there's gaps for things consumers like that are not on the shelf, and then there's a cannibalization and over expression of one thing. And so there's too much competition in one category, and it doesn't make sense. If you can fill in the gaps of what is needed on the shelf, everyone would be more happy.
That's really interesting. I guess what I'm asking is, do you think a day will come when this technology is available to consumers that I'll be able to look at something and go, yes, I will like that, or no, I won't?
It is available to consumers today. I'm sorry, we never really touched on that because our company is so focused on the supply chain leading up to the consumer, but actually there's a consumer-facing product. We It's powered by Tastry. We plug the intelligence of recommending wine to consumers into retail locations and e-commerce sites and places like that. And it absolutely does recommend wine to you as an individual, or, you know, to a group of people. And it does it really well. That's how we understand in a large part what consumers like. We just don't, as a technology heavy company, we don't really focus on the consumer facing side of the business. We enable other businesses to do that just because it's not our core competency yet.
So that's, yes, not until System Alagut and LCBO come knocking, but let's go back to the quiz. Can you talk me about through the quiz, first of all, how you developed it and why you asked those particular questions and what's on the quiz?
Oh, well, so I can actually send you a link, but it would be, the questions are something like, do you like black coffee, or I'm sure you've seen similar whimsical looking quizzes, or tomatoes, or mineral water, or dark chocolate, and things like that. The reason those questions were asked is because we had a hypothesis that those questions were analogs that could be tied to the underlying chemistry of products like wine. And the reason we want to ask those questions and give you a very simple way to tell us what you don't like and don't like without having to know anything about wine is because you can't scale understanding of what consumers across the US would like by running multi-million dollar tasting panels year over year. It's cost prohibitive. It's not possible. So this was all about finding a way to bypass having to have a very expensive, time-consuming, unreliable way to understand what consumers want. The quiz is like a ultra modern focus group where you don't really have to do anything.
So take one of those foods, dark chocolate. Is dark chocolate predictive of wine taste because there are compounds in chocolate that are very similar to certain compounds in wine? Why dark chocolate?
There are compounds in those foods that do exist in wine, but it's, again, I know humans love very simple answers.
This human does. Give me a very simple answer.
But it's not a one. But that's not. It's not a one-to-one relationship.
Right.
So if there's dark chocolate compounds in your wine, that does not mean you're going to like those compounds in your wine. That's not what it's doing. It's not saying I'm taking out all the comp. If you hate dark chocolate, I'm not taking out all of the wines that have those compounds associated with it in the wine. All it's doing is it's kind of like a Venn diagram with different overlaps. It's just identifying.
Okay. I guess one of the questions, and you've probably been asked this a million times, is once you have a data-driven approach, I guess a lot of people are going to be frightened that the artistry is going to be removed. What do you say to that?
I would say we're...
I should tell the listeners that she's clutching her head at the question.
it's very short-sighted. I would say yes. If you had asked a winemaker, would they be looking at data to help them make wine making decisions 5 years ago, they would have laughed at you. But now we have some of the most prolific, some of the most respected winemakers openly talking about how they are doing amazing things with this technology on our platform. And people imagine technology as being this sort of terminator. Don't get me wrong, there's always a consequence to everything, right? But when they see what it actually is, it's a software with numbers on it. It's not a terminator robot. It's a tool in the toolbox, and it's kind of like a paintbrush for the artist is the way I have heard winemakers describe it, in that they're actually, in this particular case, winemakers are more emboldened to pursue their goals or vision with the wine, especially when there's friction and pressure from business or a gatekeeper or someone else to do something else.
That's interesting. So I guess in some cases it could give the winemaker the backup they need to do the thing they wanted to do anyway, if I understand what you're saying.
Well, yeah. I mean, as a winemaker, There are cases where you just make whatever you want and you have a good time doing it and people love it. In a lot of cases, it is a business and you have to sell the wine. In a lot of cases, sales, marketing, ownership might not agree with how you perceive this product should be made. And there's certain pressures to do things a certain way, to, and it goes stale, right? That's what happens. It's ironic because the most successful wine labels that take off, at least in the US, were a total fluke and a total experiment by the winemaker, and the wine doesn't fit any pre-existing wine style, and it was just something new and fresh and exciting, and it took off, and you can't compare to anything else. And winemakers are inclined to do that, but they're kind of prevented from doing that because there's a business component. This provides reassurance that doing something new is not going to be a liability.
So if I've understood what you've said previously, it's also that people can do these new and interesting things, and you can say, okay, you've done this, this is where you should sell it. Is that right?
That's exactly right.
Right, okay. All right, so let's talk a bit about, we've talked a lot about wine, but there's applications for this in things like perfume and food as well. So what are you doing in those spheres, or what do you plan to do in those spheres?
We are currently working on the technology for RTDs and RTSs, and we have a beer and spirits database and a coffee fragrance, hot sauce. We've analyzed other products just to say that we can and to know that we can. Having said that, I'm also very good at saying no, and I've also gotten really good at saying no, and those are extracurricular experiments at the moment, and if there's a business case, we will pursue it, but just focusing on the wine industry for a team of our size is quite an arduous task, so we like to stay disciplined and focus on one vertical at a time for now and get that right.
So if you didn't have all of these business constraints yourself, what's the question that you would like answered if you could go off and just, you know, do a hobby?
So one thing we're really interested in, if there was no time or resource constraints, is we built a beer recommender before, for example, and there are correlations between if we can predict how much you like a wine, we can to a more accurate extent predict what kind of beer you like. And I want to know, like, what other CPG or other products are there that can be linked together to understand who you are for all sorts of foods and flavors? So, like, for example, diacetyl is found in a buttery Chardonnay, right? It's also found in the buttered popcorn at the movie theater or the butter pecan ice cream in the grocery store aisle. So I want to know, how do I understand all of that, because wine is just one flavor matrix, right?
So you sound like you one day will have a unified theory of taste.
I suppose that's an elegant way to put it. Yeah, that'd be interesting.
That's really interesting. Do you think taste, as in mouth taste, is linked to other aesthetic areas? Like, if you like a particular type of food and drink, does that predict whether you like other things aesthetically?
I don't know yet. There's hints of it, but as a scientist at heart, I wouldn't say it quite yet. But it is possible.
Okay, so I've only got a few minutes left, so I want to turn to other things now. So you're obviously fantastically nerdy and full of chemistry and I presume mathematics as well, but now you're running a business that's got a lot of people. How did you develop the business side of your skill set?
I was fortunate. My best feature is not to be the best scientist. My best feature is finding brilliant people and getting them to work together and speak the same language. So as quickly as I could, I actually found more capable people than I. I have people around me who have much more business experience, have had much more foresight, are much better at whatever it is that I hired for them to do. And I think what made this work is, basically, every morning I wake up and I think about, what is it that I'm currently doing that could be a job for someone? And I happen to be good at finding someone who can be better than me at those things. So that I was very surprised to learn that is a more valuable skill set that I could provide to the company.
So so you've got a company that's full of mathematicians and chemists, but you've also got sales and marketing people. From a managerial perspective, how do you get those people to work together and understand each other?
Me. I think we just, when you have a culture where you create that culture, right, full of passionate people who care about the same mission, it does make things a lot easier. We all have our unique gifts, but they are quite different, but we still have enough in common, right, to collaborate on those things. That's very much a team building thing. And we have a lot of geniuses, right? Whether they're sales geniuses or math geniuses, you can't bribe them. I will tell you that much. You can't bribe genius. They really have to care about what you're doing if you want to keep them and not lose them. And we just happen to have a lot of people like that. So it works.
You tried bribing them? Do you know this empirically?
No, I mean, I don't have like a Google slide and like some office with like all these weird perks, like when you come in and there's like, I don't know, some fancy coffee machine and you get a car allowance if you work with us and like those kind of things that would attract employees, right?
I was just thinking it must actually be quite terrifying for the person who chooses the coffee in your office, given how much, you know, taste expertise there is amongst your staff. Or do you just buy Nespresso? Don't answer that. Okay, so what's next? So you're obviously very disciplined about what you do and the problems that you're solving, but what are the big wine problems that you think are still to be solved?
Well, there's a cycle in the wine industry, and the first problem we solved was winemaking and how do we work with production. But now that we have established credibility and trust there, it's all about going to the other side of the supply chain and focusing on selling all this amazing wine that is being made. So we're closing the gap, and we're trying to create a flywheel effect to build synergies between the supply chain, because you can make amazing wine, but then there's a logistics component and there's a component of getting it in the right market. And we can help with that. So that's how we go from like a 40x value to from our customers to a 200x value, is predicting more of the future, if that kind of makes sense. So vertically integrated.
And are you in Europe yet, or are you coming to Europe? Where are you going geographically?
We've done tests in Europe where we know that we can predict what is going on in Europe, but pragmatically, we would need to open up a lab somewhere in Europe to really, really focus on.
Are you seeing big differences in taste in between Europeans and the Americans, or is America inside America as heterogeneous? Let me rephrase that. Yeah, are you seeing big cultural differences in taste?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, definitely. It is cultural is exactly the right way to. I love that you asked that question, because usually people say demographics, and I usually have to correct and say it's the cultural that influences people's preferences. Yes, it is very diverse.
Okay, and so what is the biggest thing that you have learned about flavor preferences since you started doing this work?
That's a good question. It is very subjective. I think I very much confirm that. It's very like dependent on the scenario. What's the word I'm looking for?
The context?
Yeah, exactly. That it's all about the context. Thank you.
Word person meets chemistry person. All right, those are my final questions. Is there anything that I haven't asked you that you think is really important to discuss?
What has shocked me, and what I wish more people would talk about, maybe as entrepreneurs or someone who is trying to do something new in an industry, is how do you make this succeed, right? And people in the beginning would assume it's about having the best technology or the best capabilities or delivering everything your customer wants. But I learned the hardest part of this was not building the technology or delivering the product. It was very hard, but what's hard is getting people to do things differently and to change, even if it's better. So I did not know, if you had asked me 5 years ago, that I would be spending all of my time trying to change the way people see the world as opposed to just showing them my technology, I would have laughed at you. It takes time to change. And I don't think people talk about that enough.
That is really insightful. And I imagine on top of that, that there would be people who would actively find what you're doing threatening because they're worried that it would take away their autonomy or their artistry, or that it would be a cold approach to doing this. So how do you bring people round and say, no, it's actually respecting what you do. It's respecting the terroir.
We did it brick by brick. When I first started talking to winemakers, I didn't try to sell them anything. I just said, this is what I have. I want to try to understand what is useful or not useful to you about this technology. Like, how do I make it so that it's your slave, not the other way around? How do I make it useful to you? And I had hundreds of conversations like that. So the product, in a sense, was built through talking to winemakers. As we were talking to them, we were building it the way they wanted it to be built, because there's no point in this product existing if winemakers don't embrace it and use it. So it was molded by the market to be what they want it to be, if that makes sense.
Right. Well, that's a great note to end on. That's been a fascinating conversation, and I want to thank you so much for giving me your time.
Likewise. Thank you so much. I had a lot of fun.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome. Thank you.